history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty amazing stories out there just waiting to be told if we'll simply take a little time to listen. That's what we try to do every time here as we seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, we're going to learn about a couple of aspects of World War II that we don't hear about all that often. Even on this program, we haven't explored them too frequently. One would be the role of the Merchant Marines. Another, the role of Chinese Americans in World War II. We can do that because our guest belongs to both of those groups. He's also a historian, an author, and I think you'll hear over the next hour that not only is he a gentleman and a scholar, he's a sharp 91-year-old with a keen sense of humor and also a powerful perspective to share with us. Murray Lee of San Diego, California. La Jolla, to be specific. In fact, he lives just down the mountain from my favorite place in San Diego, the Mount Soledad National Veterans Memorial, which we'll hear a little more about later. But let's start, Murray, with your childhood. I'm pretty sure you didn't grow up saying, I'm going to be a historian someday and write a bunch of books.
No, I was born on a farm in Michigan, because in those days when the mothers were ready for birth, they usually went off to their parents' place or something like that. So that's what my mother did. She was living in Detroit, and so that's not far from my grandparents' home, which was near Marshall, Michigan. And so that's where she went when she had her two children, had me, and then about a year and a half later, my brother. So we were both born on that farm. But we lived in Detroit. I can remember my father had a catering store. We were in the store, my brother and I, who was about a year and 4 months younger than me, were playing there, and they had a big radiator along the front wall below the windows there. It was only a couple of feet high, and my brother was walking on that radiator, and he fell behind the radiator, and his head got stuck in there, and it was burning, scarred his cheek, and I yelled to my father to come. Of course, I was too small to get him out of there. He ran up and rescued him, but he had this scar on his cheek forever, as I remember, this burn scar. That was a traumatic sort of situation that I remember. I also remember first and only broken bone that I ever had was because I was walking on the top of a fence and fell off of it. Because, you know, I used to do these kind of stupid things. You walk along the top railing of a fence and I fell and I broke my arm.
And let me ask you, I guess, growing up, did it seem at all unique to you that your father was Chinese and your mother was white? Was that something that even occurred to you, that that was different or unique?
I'm certainly aware of it, but I didn't think about it really. I was pretty much accepted by everybody. But when you move to any new area as a kid, you're challenged by other kids. At that time, there was no Asians at all in Virginia, in Arlington County, and that. And we sort of moved out there, and I went to an elementary school, and I went to the junior high school. In a junior high school, I liked to play sports, so I was in the junior high basketball teams. And there's no way that I could qualify my size, being about 5'8", but they had a basketball team by weight. You had to be under 120 pounds. And so I qualified for that, so I signed up to play that. So we played all the other junior high schools, and we were a pretty good team, so that was kind of fun. Then high school, where I was living, we used to like to play sandlot football. I remember playing football, and I was playing as quarterback on this one team, and I was a pretty good football player. But when I went into high school, the gym teacher knew me from junior high, and he said, I'm not going to allow you to play football here, but you might break a leg or something like that. I wasn't big enough for that. It says, but you can run track. I had done pole vaulting and that, so I went on the track team as a pole vaulter. Then they said, we could use you in the half mile. I said, okay. So while I was pole vaulting, they called you for the half mile. So I went and ran a half mile. When I came back to the pole vaulting, I was so tired that was it. Wherever I was when I left would be the height that they would call me for, because there's no way that you can start pole vaulting immediately after finishing a half-mile race, because you're you're pretty well exalted. But after a little while there, I would do the broad jump. So that was where I got my letter in Washington Lee High School, which was the only high school in Northern Virginia at that time.
Well, let me ask you, something else happened while you were in high school that I'm sure was memorable, and everybody who was alive then seems to remember something about it. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you heard what happened out at Pearl Harbor?
Well, everybody, of course, heard about that. I was working, and everybody knew that they had to go into service as soon as they graduated. And a friend of mine and I said, well, what are our choices? At that time, it was like, well, we're all filled up in the Air Force on these education programs and things like that that we wanted to get into. He says, well, why don't we go and join the Merchant Marine up in Sheepshead Bay, Long Island? So that's where we went. And so when I was up there, I said, well, I'd like to get some special training, so I would like to go to radio school. And they had two radio schools. One was in the harbor there in New York, and another one was in the harbor in Boston. So what they did was, just as soon as I applied and qualified to go, they closed the schools and said, we're filled up. There's only one radio operator on each merchant ship, and we have trained enough now, so we're closing down those schools. I've always seemed to be right behind everything there. And so I said, well, what are my choices? And I said, well, you go into the engine room, or you be a steward, you know, like that's like a busboy and serve meals and things like that, or you go on deck. And I said, I don't want to go in the engine room. I want to know what's going on. If I get out there, there's a torpedo or something. I want to be up where I can see what's going on. So I just said to be on deck. We didn't have any choice. The first ship we was going on, they shipped four of us down to the Norfolk to be on a ship that was looking for people. And I know why they were looking for people, because they couldn't keep them, because this was an old ship built back in like 1916, and it didn't have a bit of paint on it. It was 100% rust. But at that time, that steel that they had was pretty good, so it lasted. So they said, okay, have you ever steered a ship? I said, no. Well, get on this wheel and follow this course. At that time, they didn't have automated, you know, steering. It was a compass, magnetic compass. So they said, follow this course. So I did, and I was very good at it, in the sense that I could see that the ship would drift. It depends upon the tide or the wind in that. And so I would adjust this to this before it did that, so that I could stay on this course. And they were looking, and, you know, they said, you know, wow, this guy can, you know, because to most of the guys that steer, the ship is going like this, winding, you know, because they compensate after it starts to turn. So anyway, when I got to the end of this was up in Boston, we were going to, hauling a load of coal, believe it or not, but it didn't affect the ship since it was all rust anyway. So when I got there, we got paid, and I got more money than these other guys that were with me on a ship, because we made you an acting able-bodied seaman because you were such a good helmsman.
And how old were you at the time?
18.
When you signed up for that, did you have any idea how dangerous that was? Because statistically, being in the Merchant Marines was as dangerous as anything in World War II.
More dangerous. But in 1942, there were more Merchant Marine sailors killed than all other services combined in the Atlantic, because the German U-boats were patrolling the Atlantic, and they weren't encountering any U.S. Navy or anything. At that time, all the efforts of the Navy were in the Pacific. So along the coast, they were sending out patrol boats and private planes and things like that. Even one private plane carried a bomb in and tried to, by hand, to drop it on a U-boat because they could see them, but they couldn't do anything about it because, you know, they were yachts and other kinds of ships along with it. And then Churchill contacted Roosevelt and said, we are an island nation. We are under attack by the Nazis. We cannot survive unless we get your food and supplies. You've got to start sending us stuff. So that's when they started the convoys. So the convoys would go out, and at first the German U-boats would say, well, there's a spot where these convoys don't have air protection out in the middle of the Atlantic. We'll sit there with our wolf packs, they call them, and we'll wait and we'll pick off all these ships because they're not getting support from North America. Well, eventually they closed that gap and they developed radar and sonar. And so then the U-boats came under attack because they could trace it. They even got the code from the German code, so they knew where these guys were going, and then the U-boats were on the run. That was a great turnabout in the Atlantic there.
But were you aware of any of that as a teenager when you signed up?
Well, no. Actually, when I signed up, I was up in the training. The war in Europe had ended. And in fact, I was in Times Square when the Japanese surrendered.
That must have been interesting.
It was, because you know that we have that famous KISS statue here in San Diego. Well, I was there when that was going on. And I remember all these guys doing that. And of course, I was too bashful to go and grab a girl, you know, that I didn't know and kiss her. But I saw all these guys doing that, these Navy guys, and everybody was celebrating that. My friend and I did meet a couple of girls, and they said, oh, you want to go walk into Central Park or something with us? And I said, okay, we'll go and take a look at that. And so that was kind of interesting period, but we were very fortunate that was the end of hostilities, but it wasn't the end of danger, because when we were out in the Atlantic, we had to watch out for floating mines, because it was going up to Antwerp, and that we had a minesweeper going ahead of us. They had me go on a bow one time. They said, why don't you go do lookout on a bow? And I said, look out on a bow? If we had a mine, that's the first place it's going to blow up, right? Well, that's your job. Go do it.
What kind of ship was that you were on? What was the name of it?
That was a Liberty ship. I think it was called the Thomas Sumter. It was one of the last Liberty ships, you know, were built in here in California by Kaiser in 7 days. And they would slap these things together, and you know, you could tell that too but they carried a lot of cargo, and but they were slow. They could only make like 9 knots, so they're always lagging behind, so they're kind of the first thing that gets attacked, you know, these Liberty ships.
So you guys were taking supplies across the Atlantic, and were you bringing some troops home or no?
Well, one of those, not that particular ship, but another ship, which was a Victory ship, was converted to a troop carrier. They took everything down in the hold. They would put these 5-decker bunks in that so they could carry troops instead of cargo. And so when we loaded all these guys' troops on the ship to come back, and some of these guys, they had all their weapons with them. They'd have all these guns lying around. And the other thing that they did, they'd gamble. They had a lot of pay, you know, that they got from, you know, they'd be on the top of the cargo hold gambling. And I figured that probably by the time they got to America, there would be 1 out of 10 of those that have all the money and all the others, because there were some sharpshooters on board there. None of them wanted to go down in the hold to sleep. They said, if you won't go down there, there's going to be somebody that's going to throw up there, and it's going to smell like terrible. And so we'd rather come up on sleep on deck, and that's what they did. They did not want to go down there and sleep, and I could see why they didn't want to, because go down there and sleep in a 5-decker bunk, you know, and all with all these guys. And they were not seaworthy, so all you do is you roll a little bit, and pretty soon they're all sick. And one gets sick, they all get sick.
And I didn't want to cut you off there, interrupt. I think that was an important point you made, that hostilities were over, but the danger wasn't. Were there some times where you look back on and you say, hey, we came pretty close to that, or that was a little more treacherous than I hoped it would be?
Yeah, on that one ship, there were a lot of very rough seas. I remember approaching the, you don't realize how stormy it is around the English Channel and that, and close to that. So it was all these rough waters, and you saw, well, you had these patrol boats coming out there doing minesweeping and that. And he said, well, that's the main danger. There's a lot of loose mines around, and you can't always rely on these sweepers. And that's when I said, when I was on deck and these minesweepers were in front of me, I said, well, go be lookout on the bow. And I said, well, that's the worst place to be. When we got into the harbor, we had to wait for a while they had a channel going in there, and they had these locks. They'd have to wait to you to go in there, so they had you stand by there, and we did in this harbor right in front of Antwerp. And a storm came up suddenly and blew us up on a bank, and you went to and looked down off the ship, and you saw all this sand, you know. I said, wow, we're stuck on this side here. I said, what else can happen to this ship? And so they had to wait till high tide, and they sent these tugboats out and dragged it off the bank, and then we went up into the harbor. They sent a diver down to see if any damage had been done to the hold, you know, punctured or anything like that, because we had to go all the way back, you know. They didn't find anything, because we went up and it was sand, I think, at that spot rather than rocks, and so that worked out. And then that ship made it all the way back to the U.S. and went right straight down to Norfolk, Virginia, where they had a place where all the ships were anchored. It's a graveyard, I guess, because they had too many ships and they didn't need all of these. And that ship was already ready for burial. Everything that happened to it, because we were adrift for 4 days in the Atlantic, and they tried to tow us, and the tow rope broke because we had this huge, huge cargo of sugar, and that was so heavy. This one ship that tried to tow us got started, and tow rope snapped. If you're anywhere on deck when that tow rope snaps, you better watch out, because that thing whips around and can take your legs right off. But anyway, somebody was smart enough to know, say, hey, we got this whole cargo of sugar. Let's burn it to get the boilers going. So that's what they did. They burned our sugar. So sugar does burn, fortunately. So that was some of the more interesting things.
Were there moments in there where you were frightened, where you're thinking, I don't know if this was the best idea, and I don't know if I'm going to get back and see my family again?
Well, that's possible. I didn't tend to try to think about that. One trip down in Argentina, and as you remember, a lot of the high-level Nazis escaped, and they went to Argentina, took different names and things like that. I remember when we went off the ship in Argentina, we were walking to shore to Buenos Aires. There was this guard that stopped us, and he looked like a Gestapo guy. He had his black, you know, boots and all that sort of stuff like that, because they had a lot of Germans down there. And anyway, he wanted to examine us. He checked all our pockets and everything, and I had a small knife in my pocket, which every seaman has, because, you know, it's an emergency. You need to cut a rope or something like that. And he took that. So I said, well, what am I going to do? That was a welcome to Buenos Aires.
You're just speculating that he was one of those escaped Nazis, or did that seem pretty clear to you?
He evidently was kind of like a sympathizer. I don't think he was a German, but was not a welcome. I mean, here we're delivering stuff to them. It's not like we are enemy ship or something like that. We're bringing cargo to you.
So how long did you end up staying in the Merchant Marines?
2 years. Truman wrote something, which I have a copy of, to me and to all the merchant seamen, saying, we are very thankful for your service in the Merchant Marine. We figure that you have served your 2 years requirement, and you are exempt, you know, from being drafted. Because a lot of the people in Congress said, well, these guys never served in the military. It's like the Merchant Marine was not part of our war effort. You're going to have to sign up for a draft. And I remember going down to somewhere in Virginia where they were doing recruiting, signing people up. And I went down there, and everybody was to take a test. So I did this, and I finished it and turned it in. They called me up to where the officers were and said, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to purposely flunk this test so that you don't qualify for service? And I said, no, I don't think so. I said, well, you hardly got any questions right. I said, well, I thought the test was very easy. Maybe I didn't miss anyone. In fact, I was helping one of the other guys there, because a lot of those guys were there, couldn't read, and I was reading the questions to them and that. And the other guy that was up there said, yeah, he did do that. Then they came back and he said, oh, we're so sorry. We had 2 exams, you know. We used the wrong one to grade yours. You really did get almost all the questions right. We apologize to you for this. I said, well, I thought, these guys, I said, I don't want to be in this. So they said, well, we have a place for you. And they started to be real nice, you know, and totally changed their whole attitude. I ended up actually, I was married at the time, and we had our first child and that. And so I eventually became exempt. And it wasn't until 1980-something that they granted Merchant Marine veteran status. But then all the veterans' benefits are gone.
So someone who served in the Army or the Navy or the Marines or the Army Air Corps or the Coast Guard, they could go to college and use the GI Bill. But even though you were risking your life, you didn't have that.
I had to work my way through school. Of course, I was going to George Washington University, and they had night classes and weekend classes, so I was taking all these classes. We had a first son, so I hardly saw him for that year, because I was working nights and weekends and everything, and finally graduated. I did earn Phi Beta Kappa.
And that would lay the foundation for the extensive research and writing he's done since. You can check out some of the books he's written and order them if you want at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And his story has quite a few more twists and turns to take. Back with more from Murray Lee of San Diego, California, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.